And you talk about them, too, as both cultural icons, which they are to all of us, but also suspects in a way. It's that whole notion of when your death gets reported in the newspaper, your arrest record is as well. That's a terrible thing. And I think you really make people feel the emotional outrage that accompanies that.
Well, thank you. I think that comes straight from the mouths of talking to the musicians and other people. There are, we all know there are shootings in New Orleans. Sometimes those shootings happen at parades. And so there's a lot of backlash from the musicians and the members of the clubs that organize these parades that say, look, there's violence on the streets of New Orleans, and we're all impacted by it, and we all feel terrible about it, and we all want it to stop. And then for those people who are tragically murdered, in many cases, the NOPD will report if they've had any type of prior arrest. And the musicians are very upset about that because it makes the victims of these crimes undifferentiated from the suspects and the perpetrators. And what Benny said about De Niro when De Niro was killed in 2006 is, look, if you watched the news all day, all you'd think 20-something black New Orleanians were into doing is killing. But De Niro was a school teacher. He was a working musician. He was a stand-up dad and brother and son to his mom. And who's going to tell that story?
He was an inspiration.
A real inspiration.
You know, and people deserve to know that, I think.
And I'll tell you, I love the Hot Eight, and I love their music today. But Benny, the band leader, would be the first to tell you that with De Niro's absence, the music changed too, that he really brought something to that position, a very driven young man. And that's one of the things I want to get across in the book too, is it's not just tradition bearers. These are creative musicians who put their stamp on this amazing tradition.
And who are moving it forward and out into the world.
Yeah.
One of the other things you describe so clearly and wonderfully are the economic inequities that these guys face in their professional lives. I wonder if you talk a little bit about that. Jazz Fest, for example, playing for the Saints.
It's difficult to talk about because our whole local economy is based on our culture, right? People come to New Orleans for our food, for our beautiful architecture, maybe because they can have a little drink out in public they can't do back home in Ohio, wherever they're coming from. And, of course, to hear our music and to dance to it and to feel that spirit and joy that we get to do in New Orleans every day. And that our city has really embraced music and culture as the root of our economy. And that keeps a lot of musicians working and in business. And they know, in a sense, that we need tourism and visitors to come to this city just for our daily bread. And then the question the musicians often ask is there pay on a level with that kind of draw that they have to bring people into the city? A lot of them, but I would estimate, are earning about the same wages as the bellhops and the waiters at our restaurants, which we could discuss whether that's equitable, but the musicians don't feel that way because they have such a draw to bring people in. The Jazz Fest example is very, very complicated because Jazz Fest employs lots of musicians, including myself, and they're a great organization. They give a lot to the community. They often give to the Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs. They give free concerts all the time. What the musicians ask is they appreciate that, and they appreciate the exposure Jazz Fest gives, but they wonder why the national acts are being paid exponentially higher than them over time when New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival is so based in the culture of New Orleans. And the joke I came up with is, we don't go to Newport Folk Festival to hear the music of Newport, because that would be a very short and boring festival. I'm sure Rhode Island has some good music, but we're New Orleans, and so that's the real draw for a lot of these people, is the New Orleans food and the music, and the musicians wonder if they're getting financially the respect that they deserve. And I think that's an open question. It's a difficult question.
Mm-hmm. Now, this book is graced by some really lovely illustrations by Willie Birch. I wonder if you'd talk about how that collaboration came about.
Absolutely. Willie's become a real mentor to me and a great friend, and that process started when I saw a painting he'd done of a Second Line parade. He does these massive life-size black and white paintings using a technique called grisaille, where he washes over charcoal. It gives this real depth And I was just transfixed by this Willie Birch. I'd never heard of Willie Birch. This was before Katrina, maybe 2003 or four. And I was presenting a talk at Tulane, and I look out in the audience, and Willie Birch is in there. So I went up and introduced myself. I told him how I'd love to get to know him better. And he said, well, I want to read what you're doing before we do another thing. Very, very strong personality, Willie Birch. And I gave him an article I wrote. He called me up, said, I love this. I want more. And I said, well, listen, I'm finishing up this book. And in the back of my mind, I've had this dream forever of your images being in it. And he said, well, I can't do that until I read the book and tell you what I think. And he gave me that manuscript back, marked up in red pen. He'd read the whole thing front to back, told me exactly how he felt, had a lot of suggestions for me, mostly about bringing myself out more in, as the narrator in the book, and said, sure, I'd love to add my work to your work. And so there's 25 of his paintings interspersed throughout the book. And then we actually co-wrote the afterword, which is the last thing I wrote in the book with Willie, and one of my favorite parts of the book, where we really just kind of riff off one another.
It's a lot of fun.